Hello and welcome to Advanced Placement United States History Podcast, episode number 35. Today we'll be taking a look at the Eisenhower administration and the Cold War. In 1952, the Democrats nominated Illinois Governor Adlai Stevenson for the presidency. Republicans, meanwhile, nominated former World War II General and NATO Supreme Commander Dwight Eisenhower for president, with former Red Hunting Richard Nixon of HUAC fame as his running mate. Eisenhower's status as a war hero and Nixon's reputation for being tough on communists gave the Republicans an easy victory. They won the popular vote by a 7 million vote margin and also won a landslide in the Electoral College with 442 electoral votes to Stevenson's 89. By the time Eisenhower took the oath of office in 1953, American soldiers had been entrenched in Korea for nearly 3 years. In the time since MacArthur's final retreat to the 38th parallel, thousands more Americans had died without any territorial loss or gain to speak of. Eisenhower eventually brought about an armistice with North Korea, in part by making it known that he, unlike Truman, would consider the use of nuclear weapons in Korea. Despite the armistice, however, the border between North and South Korea has remained one of the most heavily fortified Cold War hotspots in the world for more than 50 years. As Eisenhower entered the White House in 1953, he was determined to roll back Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal liberalism, which he derided as creeping socialism. A Republican, Eisenhower wanted to reduce the size and influence of the federal government, give more power to state governments, and allow corporate profits to boost the national economy unfettered. Less government influence, he reasoned, would put America back on track. He appointed prominent businessmen to top cabinet posts in an effort to make the executive branch more efficient. Most Americans praised his hands-off approach to government after 20 years of heavy social engineering under Roosevelt and Truman. Eisenhower's desire to halt creeping socialism did not, however, mean dismantling the new social welfare programs previously put in place. Eisenhower proved to be a big proponent of programs and policies designed to help those at the bottom rung of the economic ladder who needed help the most. He created the cabinet-level Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and allowed the government to continue to subsidize farmers so that the price of farm products remained high. Eisenhower expanded Social Security in order to benefit more Americans, including the elderly and unemployed, and also dumped more federal dollars into the Federal Housing Administration to help Americans purchase new homes. Most important, Eisenhower endorsed the Federal Highway Act in 1956, calling for the construction of a network of interstate highways which would improve national transportation. In fewer than 20 years, this highway construction became the largest public works project in U.S. history and cost more than $25 billion. New taxes on gasoline, oil, and trucks helped pay for this massive endeavor. The new interstates had an enormous impact on the growth of the suburbs and prosperity, but also severely crippled the development of public transportation systems. Afraid that a Republican in the White House would mean the end of organized labor, which had flourished under the Democrats and during World War II, the heads of the rival American Federation of Labor and the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the AFL and the CIO, labor unions emerged in 1955 to create the AFL-CIO. This new superunion joined between 10 and 15 million workers under a single umbrella organization and helped millions of families achieve unprecedented prosperity. Never again have so many American laborers been organized in one body. Scandal after scandal rocked the organization in the 1960s and 70s, including the expulsion of the Teamsters Union from the AFL-CIO in 1957 for having ties to organized crime. The media attention tarnished organized labor in the public eye and convinced millions to leave the union. Congress eventually passed the 1959 Landrum-Griffin Act in the wake of these scandals to limit labor unions' rights. Eisenhower privately opposed the civil rights movement and remained relatively silent as the movement began to gain momentum during his presidency. He made no comment after the Supreme Court ruled unanimously in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka that separate but equal public facilities for blacks and whites were unconstitutional. He signed the Civil Rights Act of 1957, but only reluctantly and only after assuring Southern legislators that the new law would have little real impact. Eisenhower did, however, exert federal authority that same year when Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus defied a federal court order and mobilized National Guard units to prevent 9 black students from entering Central High School in Little Rock. Eisenhower resolved the Little Rock crisis by placing the National Guard under federal control and sending more than 1,000 U.S. Army soldiers to protect the students and integrate the school by force. Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy's communist witch hunt overshadowed all other domestic issues during Eisenhower's 2 terms in office. Hoping to boost his own status as a national politician, McCarthy first capitalized on Americans' fears of communism when he announced in 1950 that the State Department had become overrun with more than 200 communists. He claimed that these communists, including Truman's own Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, were working secretly to hinder American efforts against the Soviet Union. Although McCarthy never offered any actual proof to back up his claims, McCarthyism swept across the nation like wildfire. Thousands of individuals, including liberals, critics of the Korean War and the Cold War, civil rights activists, homosexuals, feminists, and even critics of McCarthy himself, were blacklisted and fired from their jobs. As a congressman and later as vice president, Richard Nixon fully supported McCarthy, as did future President Ronald Reagan, who at the time held the influential position of president of the Screen Actors Guild. In response to McCarthyism, author and playwright Arthur Miller, who had himself been branded a communist, wrote the 1953 play The Crucible, a critique of the Red Hunts disguised as a play about the Salem witch trials of the 1600s. Eventually, McCarthy ruined his own name after accusing high-ranking members of the U.S. military of being communists. During the televised Army-McCarthy hearings of 1954, millions of Americans watched as the senator made wild accusations without a shred of evidence. These hearings and the Senate's subsequent formal reprimand of McCarthy effectively ended the Red Hunts. Disgraced and discredited, McCarthy became an alcoholic and died in 1957. In addition to his desire to halt the advance of creeping socialism in U.S. domestic policy, Eisenhower also wanted to roll back the advances of communism abroad. After taking office in 1953, he devised a new foreign policy tactic to contain the Soviet Union and even win back territory that had already been lost. Devised primarily by Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, the so-called New Look at foreign policy proposed the use of nuclear weapons and nuke technology rather than ground troops and conventional bombs, all in an effort to threaten massive retaliation against the USSR for communist advances abroad. In addition to intimidating the Soviet Union, this emphasis on new and cheaper weapons would also drastically reduce military spending, which had escalated rapidly during the Truman years. As a result, Eisenhower managed to stabilize defense spending, keeping it at roughly half the congressional budget during most of his 8 years in office. The doctrine of massive retaliation proved to be dangerously flawed, however, because it effectively left Eisenhower without any options other than nuclear war to combat Soviet aggression. This dilemma surfaced in 1956, for instance, when the Soviet Union brutally crushed a popular democratic uprising in Hungary. Despite Hungary's request for American recognition and military assistance, Eisenhower's hands were tied because he knew the USSR would stop at nothing to maintain control of Eastern Europe. He could not risk turning the Cold War into a nuclear war over the interests of a small nation such as Hungary. As an alternative, Eisenhower employed the CIA to tackle the specter of communism in developing countries outside the Soviet Union's immediate sphere of influence. Newly appointed CIA Director Allen Dulles, the Secretary of State's brother, took enormous liberties in conducting a variety of covert operations. Thousands of CIA operatives were assigned to Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Middle East and attempted to launch coups, assassinate heads of state, arm anti-communist revolutionaries, spread propaganda, and support despotic pro-American regimes. Eisenhower began to favor using the CIA instead of the military because covert operations didn't attract as much attention and cost much less money. A CIA-sponsored coup in Iran in 1953, however, did attract attention and heavy criticism from liberals both at home and in the international community. Eisenhower and the Dulles brothers authorized the coup in Iran when the Iranian government seized control of the British-owned Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. Afraid that the popular, nationalist, Soviet-friendly Prime Minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, would then cut off oil exports to the United States, CIA operatives convinced military leaders to overthrow Mossadegh and restore Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi as head of state in 1953. Pahlavi returned control of Anglo-Iranian oil to the British and then signed agreements to supply the United States with almost half of all the oil drilled in Iran. The following year, a similar coup in Guatemala over agricultural land rights also drew international criticism and severely damaged U.S.-Latin American relations. In an odd twist, Eisenhower actually supported the communist-leaning Egyptian president Gamal Abdel Nasser during the 1956 Suez Crisis. Hoping to construct a new dam on the Nile River to provide electricity and additional land for farming, the nationalist Nasser approached the British and American officials with requests for economic assistance. When the negotiations collapsed, Nasser turned to the Soviet Union for help and then seized British-controlled Suez Canal, which linked the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. Great Britain and France asked Eisenhower for military assistance to retake the canal, but Eisenhower refused, forcing the two powers to join with Israel in 1956 to retake the canal themselves. Eisenhower condemned the attack on Egypt and exerted heavy diplomatic and economic pressure on the aggressors. Unable to sustain the action in the face of U.S. disapproval and financial pressures, Great Britain and France withdrew. In 1957, in order to protect American oil interests in the Middle East, Eisenhower announced the Eisenhower Doctrine, which stated that the United States would provide military and economic assistance to Middle Eastern countries in resisting communist insurgents. Although not terribly significant, this doctrine, as well as the restoration of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi in Iran, demonstrated the growing importance of oil in American foreign policy decision-making. A growing crisis in French Indochina proved to be no less challenging for Eisenhower than the Suez Crisis. Ever since World War I, Vietnamese nationalists under the leadership of Ho Chi Minh had sought independence from France, the colonial power in the region. Although originally more nationalist and anti-colonial than communist, Ho turned to the Soviet Union in the 1950s after U.S. officials had rebuffed his earlier requests for help in securing independence. The USSR supplied money and arms to the Viet Minh forces, putting Eisenhower in the difficult position of supporting a French colonial possession in order to contain the Soviet Union. When the key French garrison at Dien Bien Phu fell to Ho Chi Minh's troops in 1954, Eisenhower promised to assist the French economically. Many U.S. foreign policy thinkers feared that if one Southeast Asian country fell to communism, all the others would fall as well, just like a row of dominoes. This so-called domino theory prompted Secretary of State Dulles and Vice President Nixon to advocate the use of nuclear weapons against the North Vietnamese. Remembering the fruitless war in Korea, however, Eisenhower merely responded, "I can conceive of no greater tragedy than for the United States to become engaged in all-out war in Indochina." Nevertheless, Eisenhower's financial commitment to contain communism in Vietnam after the fall of Dien Bien Phu laid the groundwork for what eventually evolved into the Vietnam War. An international convention in Geneva, Switzerland, tried to avert further conflict in Vietnam by temporarily splitting the country into two countries, with a dividing line at the 17th parallel. Ho Chi Minh erected his own government in Hanoi, in North Vietnam, while Americans supported Ngo Dinh Diem, founded a South Vietnamese government in Saigon. This Geneva Conference agreement stipulated that the division would be only temporary, a stopgap to maintain peace until national elections could be held to reunite the country democratically. Although the Soviet Union consented to the agreement, Eisenhower rejected it. Instead, he pledged continued economic support to Ngo Dinh Diem and convinced Great Britain, France, Australia, and other regional nations to join the mostly symbolic Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, or CETO, modeled after the highly successful NATO. In October 1957, Soviet scientists shocked the world when they announced they had successfully launched the first man-made satellite, Sputnik 1, into orbit. They followed up on this landmark achievement several months later with the launch of Sputnik 2. Although the satellites themselves posed no danger to the United States, Americans feared that the Soviet Union now had the ability to attack New York or Washington with nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles, or ICBMs, from anywhere on the planet. In reality, Soviet ICBM development program lagged far behind its American counterpart. Nevertheless, the fear that the Soviet Union would win the space race before the United States even launched its first satellite spurred Eisenhower and Congress into action. Eisenhower created the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, in 1958 to spearhead the American space program. Congress, meanwhile, increased defense spending and passed the National Defense Education Act in 1958 to fund more science and foreign language classes in public schools. For a brief period, during Eisenhower's final years in office, it seemed that the United States and the Soviet Union might resolve their differences peacefully and perhaps even end the Cold War. Upon Premier Joseph Stalin's death in 1953, Stalin's former enemy, Nikita Khrushchev, took control of the Communist Party and eventually became premier in 1956. Khrushchev denounced Stalin's brutal treatment of the Russian people and halted nuclear testing in order to divert more money to the struggling Soviet economy. U.S.-Soviet relations also improved dramatically after Khrushchev spent 2 weeks touring the United States in 1959. He and Eisenhower even had a cordial meeting at the Woodsy Presidential Retreat at Camp David in Maryland. Many Americans hoped that the so-called spirit of Camp David would ease tensions between the two superpowers. After returning home to Moscow, Khrushchev invited Eisenhower to visit the Soviet Union and hold a multilateral summit in Paris the following year. The plans fell apart, however, after the Soviet Union shot down an American U-2 spy plane in 1960. Eisenhower and the U.S. government initially denied the existence of U-2 missions over the Soviet Union, but then the USSR produced the American pilot, whom they had captured alive. Embarrassed, Eisenhower refused to apologize or promised to suspend future spy missions against the USSR. The U-2 incident instantly repolarized the Cold War, reversing the thaw that Khrushchev's visit had brought and forcing the abandonment of the Paris summit. Facing a two-term limit, Eisenhower delivered his farewell address in January 1961. Ironically, he used his last speech as president to address a problem that he himself had had a hand in creating, the increasing dependence on nuclear weapons as a tool of foreign policy. By 1960, a growing number of Americans had begun to protest the United States' apparent willingness to wage nuclear warfare. Eisenhower had also begun to see nuclear weapons as more of a threat to global security than as a stabilizer. Afraid that the U.S. government and even American civil liberties might succumb to the power of what he called the military-industrial complex, Eisenhower cautioned that the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Although little was made of Eisenhower's words at the time, his words came back to haunt Americans during the Vietnam War. That's it for this episode. Please join us next time for episode 36. We'll take a look at the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement.